Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Christina E., Assistant Professor of Modern Japanese Literature at the University of British Columbia, who'll be talking about her book, Colonizing Language, Cultural Production and Language Politics in Modern Japan and Korea, which was published in 2018 by Columbia University Press. Japan and Korea's relationship continues, like a lot of East Asian affairs, to be caught up in discussions of the past, whether ancient or more recent. Korea's experience of Japanese imperialism in the first half of the 20th century is arguably of most enduring significance within this, and questions of guilt, responsibility, and atonement continue to pervade ties between these two countries, which otherwise have a great deal in common in terms of culture and interests. The complexities of today's relationship owe a lot to the lasting personal, cultural, and political entanglements which empire invariably spawns, and Christina E.'s Colonizing Language offers a fresh new linguistic and literary analysis of these entanglements and, equally importantly, their long afterlives. In a book which the author herself calls A Discursive History of Modern Japanese Language Literature from Korea and Japan, E's reading of life in and after empire is in its very form expressive of the period's tangled and irresolvable legacies. Nimbly moving back and forth between the Japanese metropole and the colonies and post-colonies, her narrative explores the work of, and bear with me here, both Korea and Japan-based Korean writers and Japanese writers living in Japan, Korea, or other colonies. It quickly becomes clear that it's quite difficult to attribute any single identity to all of these people, but one thing they do share is use of Japanese language and an embeddedness in the colonial context, which E interrogates. Among many other critical innovations, E carries her study of the complex and multivalent worlds conjured up in these writers' texts beyond the 1945 end of empire. And with this rare link to the present, she makes poignantly clear how issues of identity and voice are still shaped by imperial experience, asking what it might mean to think of a wider sphere of Japanese language literature that resists being anchored to today's inflexible nation-states. But to discuss these and many other things in a pretty flexible way, I hope, I'll say Christina E., welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you very much for that very eloquent summary of the book.
Well, I think hopefully we'll get into a lot more of even more interest during our conversation. But before we dive into the content itself, perhaps I could begin a bit by asking you to say something about your background and how you came to focus on Japan and Korea, literature and language and the like.
Mm-hmm. So I received my PhD from Columbia University, and I was working with Tomi Suzuki, who is a specialist of modern Japanese literature, but then also Ted Hughes, who's a specialist of modern Korean literature. So very lucky to actually have those two figures there guiding me from the very beginning. And actually, I began this project thinking that I would do a study on contemporary Zainichi Korean writers. So just to explain this term very quickly, in case there are listeners who may not know, the word Zainichi could be literally translated as residing in Japan. And of course, the most commonly refers to the ethnic Korean population in Japan, which emerged during the colonial period and was a result, of course, of the Japanese colonization of Korea. But in any case, yes, I was very much interested in the rising attention that's been paid to writers such as Lee Kai-sei, who was the first scientific Korean to win this very prestigious Akutagawa Prize in 1972, but then also people like Lee Yang-ji, who was the first scientific Korean woman to win the prize in 1988. But yes, the more that I read their works and literary criticism about their works, the more that I found myself actually having to move back in time, in part because the works themselves in some ways demanded that I do so. So there's this constant engagement with an often very emotionally fraught acknowledgement of the legacies of Japanese imperialism. Yes, I was also very acutely conscious of the potential danger, perhaps, of talking about scientific Korean literature as if it exists in a vacuum, so as if it is completely severed from the larger Japanese or Korean literary landscape, when, of course, it is very much not. So that is, in a nutshell, how I ended up conceiving the parameters of the book, which is, in some ways, is not actually a book about scientific Korean literature at all, but about Japanese language cultural production from the 1930s through the 1950s, which is actually before the word scientific comes to gain its discursive force in Japan.
Right. And I think this is what's so compelling about the way the book is framed, is that kind of inseparability in many ways of the Korean and the Japanese elements and the difficulties in categorization. I just wonder, since you mentioned that you had the good fortune of studying the Japanese and the Korean dimensions in parallel, I wonder about your sort of linguistic training and background. Again, links and entanglements between the two languages is something that is explored in the book. So what was the sort of linguistic dimension of your own training and upbringing and so on?
So I was born and raised in the U.S. And my parents are from South Korea originally. So they came to the U.S. and I was born about a year after they had immigrated. And my first language is English. And I grew up in an environment where my parents would speak to me in Korean, but I would speak back in English. And it wasn't actually until much later that I realized, in fact, that the Korean that my parents were speaking to me was not a standardized Korean, but in fact, a dialect. They come from Jeollanam-do, which has a very distinct dialect. And so that was the language that I grew up hearing. And I only, the first time I ever visited Korea was when I was a high school student. And it was a shock to me, actually, to be navigating Seoul and thinking that I knew Korean, when in fact realizing that the Korean that I knew was not the Korean that people were speaking in the street to me. And I'm trying to figure out why this was. I guess it's a kind of a personal story, but one is linked, I think, also to the personal motivations of this book. That same trip is when I first met my grandparents for the first time, both sets. And I have this very vivid memory of meeting my grandfather in particular, and because at the time, again, I could listen, I could understand their Korean, but I could only speak back in English. And so it's a very stilted conversation that we were having. But as soon as he found out that I was learning Japanese, I just actually had started learning Japanese in high school, his face lit up. And immediately he switches to Japanese and he says, oh, you know, what do you think of the language? Like, how far have you gone? And we start having a conversation. And I'm really happy because I can now use this language to have a conversation with our grandfather in a way that I can't do in either Korean or in English. But my parents, who are also in the room, were so uncomfortable and so upset with hearing actually my grandfather speaking in this language that my mother, in fact, she had to physically leave the room. And again, as a high school student, 15 years old, I have no idea what's going on. I have no idea what the undercurrents are. And it's, I think, only afterwards when I started to learn more about the history of Japan-Korea relations and then the fundamental role that the Japanese language plays, right, in mediating those relations, that I realized for my parents, right, hearing my grandfather speak Japanese was necessarily tied to all these issues of very post-colonial issues of collaboration, kind of colonial history, and so on.
Sure. Well, and that actually says a lot. It explains, I think, a good deal about the attention to nuance and the delicate way that you deal with so many of the issues that come up in the book. That very personal contact with these kinds of questions really. Yeah, I think it sets the book in a very interesting context there. But we'll move on to discussing the book itself, perhaps, or at least step by step, but move into it. Because actually, before you even begin the introduction, you have what I suppose many books have, an outline of how language has been dealt with in the text. You know, I think lots of books of all kinds say something about how they've transcribed certain languages or how translations are dealt with and so on. But it seems to me that in this case, the note on script and on translation and so on is actually central to the argument in many regards, or at least something that sets things up pretty interestingly. So could you just say something about how you dealt with transcribing the text that you're dealing with, things like how you managed Korean versus Japanese transcriptions of the sinographs, the Chinese characters that appear in the texts. What was your approach in digesting the literature and the written work that forms the body of the analytical material in the book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as you mentioned, the book actually starts with a very long preamble where I detail the decisions that I made in transcribing names and terminology. And in some ways, the whole point of the book is that we cannot take the act of naming casually. This is the site where language ideology is produced and made visible. So I really wanted to spend that time outlining to the readers my decisions. Just to give some context, the majority of Korean writers who wrote in Japanese between the 1930s and the 1950s published under Korean names, but ones rendered in sinographs without any glosses usually, which leaves the question of pronunciation open. Others published under deliberately hybrid names, with surnames, for example, that were marked as Japanese in origin, but then with Korean given names. Then we have the issue of transliterating names from Japanese language fiction. So in the case of stories written in Japanese but set in Korea, for example, this question arises, do you use the Korean rendering of character names or do you transliterate them according to their Sino-Japanese pronunciations? Right, there are lots of different possibilities that are available there. But again, because I didn't want to impose my own idea of an originary name or an originary reading, I essentially took different approaches depending on the place and venue, a publication for a particular text, expectations of the target readership, the workings of the text itself. But I also tried to include alternate readings whenever relevant in order to acknowledge the possibility of a multiplicity of readers and reading practices. And that also goes, for the romanization of author names. And in fact, I provide an index then at the back of the book listing all of the major authors I analyzed and the sinographs for their names, their pen names, different romanization conventions, and so on, in part because the romanization of assigning to Korean names in particular has been inconsistent across English language scholarship. But again, I do believe that rather than try to determine some kind of normative model, instead, it's important that we understand and interrogate the circumstances that have led to these differences in the first place.
Absolutely, yeah. And the way that you elucidate that, the way it recurs throughout the text, I think it really takes us in a very vivid way into that world, into that sort of hybrid sphere, the difficulties of separating these worlds and the kind of, the conundrums, if you like, the imperial conundrums that the situation throws up in a very everyday way, because we're dealing with things as personal as names and words that are used on an everyday basis. But that's great. We'll then move into the introduction, where I think you continue to, or you really outline the parameters of the book and the difficulties in separating Korea and Japan as subjects in this topic area. So I wonder if you could start us off, and you've already alluded to this, both with that story of your grandfather there and the discussion of the names and so on. What part did language policy and language in general play in the way that Japanese empire was constructed and the way that policy was formed? And how specifically did the Korean experience of this unfold?
So as I mentioned, in the book, I focus primarily on the time period from the 1930s through the 1950s. And I do so in part because this is a crucial period of time in which writers in both Korea and Japan were forced to directly confront or rearticulate the relationship between language, literature, and various forms of belonging, whether national or imperial or otherwise. So in thinking through this relationship, I'm trying to show how contemporary divisions between, for example, Korean versus Japanese literatures cannot be understood apart from the ideologies of language that are generated out of the trajectories of Japanese imperialism. Here, I'm very much indebted to the work that various linguistic anthropologists have done, for example, Judith Irvine, who offers a very useful definition that I borrow in the book, where she talks about language ideology as a cultural or subcultural system of ideas about social linguistic relationships, she says, together with their loading of moral and political interests. But then I'm also looking at scholars such as Lee Young-suk, who has written about what she calls the ideology of the national language, the ideology of kokugo, and how various kind of moral and affective kind of emotional ties that were put into this idea of a national language were then utilized for nation-building projects within Japan, but then also then in the Japanese empire.
And in terms of the consequences that had for the emergence of something that we now think of, you know, in the 21st century as Japanese literature and Korean literature, I mean, does that complicate the picture of what these labels actually apply to? I mean, how did a sort of canon emerge within the imperial space, and what has been the sort of longer term fate of that?
I think that both of these categories, Japanese literature and Korean literature, they presume a certain national, ethnic, and linguistic confluence that's not at all innocent or casual. What I mean by that is that these categories are not descriptive labels so much as legitimizing forces, right? They're boundaries that privilege some at the expense of others in ways that are necessarily linked to larger structures of power and to historical contingency. And of course, that's where this question of literary canonization also comes into play. And by the way, because this is a podcast, you can't see me doing it. But whenever I say something like Japanese literature or Korean literature, I'm doing air quotes. So it's, these terms themselves have been kind of contested throughout the very beginnings of their conceptualization. But and this also links, I think, as you suggest, actually, back to your earlier question about how I came to be interested in this topic, and then I guess my own linguistic background. Until recently, the Japanese language texts that were written by Koreans during the period that I look at have received relatively little critical attention. One of the reasons is that following the end of the war in 1945, Korean was claimed as Korea's national language, and Japanese language texts were purged from the canon. But at the same time, these same texts were excluded from Japan's literary canon, which is reconfigured along national rather than imperial borders. But as I argue in the book, the continuities of colonialism continued even into the post-colonial period. And you really see this embodied in the creation of the so-called Zainichi, or resident Korean community.
And well, I think that's why it's for that reason, really, that the sort of legacies and the subsequent treatment that some of these writers who, as you mentioned, have really fallen between or slipped through the cracks, both to scholars, but also, I guess, to reading publics. It's in a way very expressive of empire and its kind of afterlife that it's not something we always immediately think about. But I think you make a very strong case for why looking at this dimension of imperial experience is so important. But we'll move on then, I think, into the first chapter. The book kind of is divided. You have six chapters, and the first three dealing with the period up to 1945, and then the second half kind of treating the post 1945 period. And throughout, you provide a really great kind of background in terms of what's going on historically and how that interfaces with the works, the literary texts you're dealing with. So this is probably known to many listeners, but Japan's involvement or kind of invasion and imperial projects in Korea started in 1905 and strengthened in 1910, and then really it was not a continuous project from then all the way until 1945 in terms of being consistent throughout. So I just wonder, in your first chapter, you give us a bit of a picture of how the literary landscape in Korea, as occupied by Japan, sort of shifted between those very early days of colonization in the 1900s and 1910s and up to the 1930s and 40s. So what were the sort of key events that played a role in changing Japanese language policy and therefore the linguistic and literary landscape in Korea in the sort of, later period of empire? Mm-hmm.
So one of the arguments that I make in this chapter is that this ideology of kokugo, again, to borrow from Yang-suk, this ideology of the national language is really fundamental to understanding how Korea was positioned within Japan's larger imperial project from the very beginning, but then particularly actually starting in the 1930s. And the example that I give is that during the colonial period, language policies in colonial Korea and Taiwan, in fact, they employed the term kokugo, the national language, and not Nihongo or the Japanese language. So Koreans who were speaking Japanese were said to be speaking the national language. And this distinction is an important one because it reveals some of the illogical reasoning behind Japan's colonial strategies. One of the justifications for colonization was Japan's claim that it was fighting Western imperialism. So in order to set itself apart from Europe and the U.S., the colonies had to be made both part of one with Japan, at least on the level of discourse. So we see these arguments being made long before the 1930s, but as you say, it's by no means unified, and it's constantly changing for a long time. Again, for purely practical reasons as well. Often Koreans who are speaking Japanese, they have to learn the language first. And so for them, it's conceived as a form of a foreign language. But as I argue, the Second Sino-Japanese War, 1937, profoundly influences then both the quantity and the tenor of Japanese language writings and film by Korean colonial subjects. So that's one of the key kind of watershed moments that I identify. And it's in part because Korea, as a geographical entity, was seen as a crucial bridge to the continent, and Japanese policymakers wanted to ensure that Korean subjects would be loyal to the Japanese Empire. So they launched a number of different campaigns and strategies to try to inculcate that loyalty in what is now referred to as Kōminka, or imperialization. So within that, Japanese language education or kokugo education is seen as crucial to this process, in part because Kōminka proponents are arguing that fostering love for the Japanese language among the colonized population would inevitably lead to love for the empire that language represented.
Well, that's it's very interesting the way that you trace out the means by which they sought to sort of communicate politics through linguistic policy. And it occurs to me, actually, just as you were saying it then, that this quite, in some ways, quite empty term of kokugo, the national language, you yourself account for how this shifts later on. But in the Taiwanese case, it just made me think that when Taiwanese people today say guoyu, they mean Chinese. They mean the kind of standard language of the mainland. So it's interesting the way that this has been sort of traded between the kind of East Asian realms that many of which came under Japanese Empire during this period. You also kind of go into how policy that sought to delineate who was in the empire and what place they had led to definitions for Japan and its people also being very numerous and very overdetermined, from terms like Nihonjin, Naichijin, Nihon Minzoku, all of these terms that were used for Japanese people, and Koreans, their place within that was a little ambiguous. So from a Korean point of view, could you say a bit more about, I mean, not just because you are of Korean background, but Koreans then, where were they fitting into this picture of being subjects or people of the empire?
Yes, one of the key things about Kuomintang, this word that's, abbreviation, so Kokoku Shinminka, to become an imperial subject, right, to become, right, a loyal subject of the empire and emperor, means in some ways that it gets applied throughout the empire, including mainland Japan, what is called Naiji, the kind of the interior, the inner lands. And so what a lot of Korean writers who are writing in Japanese during this term are trying to argue is that they actually can be on an equal footing with their mainland Japanese peer. They have the right to speak, to represent the empire in the same way that their mainland Japanese peers do. And some go so far as to argue that they then deserve the same rights, the same legal rights, the same kinds of social benefits as their mainland Japanese peers, which had consistently been denied to them throughout the history of Japanese colonization of Korea. So by using the national language, so-called national language, by taking the logic of imperialization, they tried to use it for their own ends and to try and decenter, I think, in some ways, the metropole, and then recenter it in Korea and recenter it through their Japanese language writings. Of course, the flip side to that is, of course, any ability to do so or any attempt to do so had to be done through Japanese. So this absolute incorporation of Koreans into the empire also meant their absolute incorporation within and through the ideologies of the national language.
And this is the subject of chapter two as we move through the way that the policies actually played out on the ground in terms of how material that was produced by Korean authors sought to enter into Japanese markets and reach Japanese readers. What about the kind of commercial side of that? How did publishers approach dealing with writing by Korean authors, and what were the sort of business opportunities that people within Japan, within the metropole, saw in developing Korea-related material?
Yes. So the 1930s, in part because, right, the escalation of war, the 1930s witnesses a crackdown on publishing throughout the empire. We have increasing censorship regulations, material restrictions. So paper becomes a regulated commodity and different forms of government pressure, of course. Mainland Japan is no exception. And publishers are very urgently trying to figure out how to accommodate both the mounting pressures of war and the demands of the reading public. And so they turn to the colonies. Manchuria, notably, is, I think, throughout the 30s and 40s, featured most prominently in the various leading journals of the day. But Korea reemerges, too, as a topic of interest. But in a lot of the journal articles and special issues that subsequently get published on Korea, there's this general refrain that, in fact, the majority of mainland Japanese readers don't know much about their own colony still. And some Korean writers take advantage then of that ignorance, to link back again to the previous question. So they're able to gain a readership by writing about Korea. But many of them find themselves in a double bind then of having to use, again, the language of the colonizer in order to speak to or against them, which is a dilemma that's certainly not unique to Korea, which many post-colonial scholars have written about in other contexts. So this is something that I tried to unpack throughout the book. In fact, the ways in which the meaning of a text is always produced through not only the form of narrative itself, but also through the larger mechanisms of literature as an industry. So the material circulation of journals, paratextuality within journals, the workings of the economic market and other types of factors. And this is true of all texts, but becomes a particularly salient issue for colonial writers, as they are already constrained by the workings of colonialism itself, which, as we all know, is a system of exploitation meant to serve the interests of the colonial state. And so the hierarchies that are developed between mainland Japanese publishers who write have the economic and just various other types of resources to solicit materials from colonial writers, but then also have the ability to market, to kind of reframe, to situate, right, their writings and their journals in a particular way is something that I look at in this chapter two.
Yeah, you bring out this one particular figure, Kikuchi Kan, who seemed to have many sort of hats that he wore as a novelist, playwright, and an entrepreneur, a promoter of some of these career-related works. Could you say a little bit more about him?
Mm-hmm. Kikuchi Kan is one of the major figures in the modern Japanese literary landscape, not only because he himself was a writer, he was publishing a lot of popular fiction actually himself, but was a businessman. He was turning various kind of literary markets to gold, it seemed like, or he was using making a profit during a time when making a profit was increasingly difficult. So, and he himself had what looked like, or to me, a very personal interest in Korea in particular. He had traveled there himself, but he also had a very professional interest, again, taking advantage of metropolitan interest in the colonies and then using that to his advantage. And he set up a lot of different mechanisms, particularly different types of prizes to try and promote actually a Japanese language literature that encompassed all of the colonies. This is the same man, in fact, who establishes the Akutagawa Prize and also the Naoki Prize, which are two very important literary prizes that are still around in Japan. So even as he's trying to develop a domestic market, he's also actually trying to incorporate Korea into that domestic market. And a lot of the writers who later become well-known for their Japanese language writings, but who were born and raised in Korea. These writers include Kim Sa-young or Chang Ak-ju. They too had got their start through Kikuchi Kan's journals and through the various literary prizes that he set up.
And this seems so important, the way that you lay out the mechanisms that underlie a book that appears in, you know, on the markets. It may just look like an artifact floating in space or just something that is isolated, but really you give such a strong sense of the underlying, as you mentioned just earlier, the colonial logics that really kind of underpin the cultural production such as this, and the way that it's so difficult in colonialism, which, as you say, is a violent and very immovable, what looks like an immovable project. How the nuances of business and politics and language, and they're all bound up together in a way that makes it crucial to understand these things in order to see how books and how these novels and things appeared to the Japanese readership at the time. So we'll move on to the final chapter of your first half here, chapter three. Here you go on to explore a little more this idea of kokumin bungaku, national literature, as a kind of construction. As you say, Kikuchi Kan and other figures were involved in sort of forging this. So in this process of trying to generate a unified imperial literature, a national literature for the Japanese Empire, what consequences did that have for distinctions between Korean and Japanese languages or life worlds or literatures indeed? And what was the fate of Korean literature, for example, in Korean under these circumstances?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this term kokumin bungaku, I guess clarify it. We can trace it back. It begins appearing in Japanese journals as early as the 1870s and 1880s as part of larger Meiji discourses on nation building. But the term, as I'm using it, is really linked to these movements in the late 1930s and very much kind of springing into action in the early 1940s, where there's this idea that literature was supposed to be something in which state nation and people were combined into one seamless whole. So in other words, it's fascist, right? It's a form of fascist literature. And it's no coincidence that the reappropriation of this term Kokumin Bungaku is happening in conjunction with the establishment of, for example, the New Order movement in Japan. But I mean, these are movements that are happening in Italy and Germany as well. And this global context is also important to keep in mind. So Kokumin Bungaku was simultaneously configured both as a national literature and as a type of world literature that can not only compete with the output of other nations, but also might stand in opposition to them, particularly from perceived influences from the US and Britain. I find it very interesting that it's this term, Kokumin Bungaku, and not, for example, Komin Bungaku, a literature of imperial subjects that really caught on in late colonial Korea. Although, of course, imperialization, Kominka, continues to undergird and kind of inform definitions of Kokumin Bungaku because it was understood to be an imperial literature. But one that, again, crucially gestured to a body of texts that were not necessarily written in or about the metropole. And one of the reasons why both Korean and Japanese writers within Korea, so not only Korean writers in Korea, but then also actually, for example, Japanese, mainland Japanese writers who had moved to Korea were kind of working within Korea, the reason why they both championed Kokumin Bungaku was, again, because in doing so, they could emphasize the constitutive role of the peripheries in the making of a new East Asian order. So this is a time when we see really an explosion of Japanese language literary production about and from the colonies. But of course, and as I argue, this attempt, right, to create an identity of the imperial subject that could supersede established colonial hierarchies, this attempt can only be done really paradoxically in the colonies and continued to be marginalized in terms of thinking about the contrast between literature produced by Japanese within mainland Japan and then literature produced outside of it.
Yeah, I mean, you cite authors, for example, Obi Juzo and other Japanese writers, as you say, based in Korea, which really helps to give us a sense of just how complicated and sort of muddied the waters were in terms of, the act of separating Japan and Korea in this literary world at the time does become very difficult. To refer back to something we discussed towards the beginning, you bring out in this chapter really clearly this sort of dancing between different possible readings of names and the ambiguity of certain characters within texts in terms of their background that you say fascinatingly would perhaps have allowed certain texts to get around censorship, but yet would have been quite legible to certain readers who would have seen a figure as a certain representative of a kind of person within the empire, but maybe wasn't so transparently so to imperial censors as a result of their names just being represented in Hanja and Kanji or in sinographs that you know meant that they had a sort of ambiguous identity in that regard. So all of that is absolutely fascinating. But we'll continue forward into the post-imperial era, perhaps to 1945 and what resulted from this period of quite strict language and literary policy that we've discussed so far. Even beyond the war years and the end of empire in 1945 that everyone is pretty familiar with, how was this end of empire or the collapse of the Japanese imperial project in mainland Asia greeted differently by Japanese and Korean writers, including those Koreans who were based in Japan?
I think I touched upon this in the introduction, but the, again, issues of terminology. So the terms that are used to describe this immediate kind of post-1945 situation are different depending on if you're talking about Japan or Korea. So in Japan, this time period is often just simply referred to as the post-war, right? Sengo, and the immediate post-war period, whereas in Korea, it's referred to as post-liberation. So already we can see how the idea of August 1945 as this absolute rupture is being conceptualized differently according to the national histories that then emerge out of that moment. And what I think is relevant in terms of language and language ideology is that after 1945, for Korean writers, this word national language, it uses right the same sinographs, and it's appropriated again kind of as is, but it's now read in Korean as Kugol and is oriented towards the Korean language, which results, again, kind of reconfiguration of the literary canons. And this is the case, too, with Korean writers in Japan during the occupation period. So they use the word Kokugo, national language, to refer to Korean, and then they use the word Nihongo to refer to Japanese. And this has a lot to do with the changing political status of Koreans in Japan during this time. And in fact, many writers, particularly Korean leftist writers, deliberately use this word kokugo to refer to Korean in order to emphasize the liberation of Korea from Japan. But as we know, what may have people celebrated as liberation and had high hopes, right, for liberation very quickly turns out not to be the case. In Korea, what we see happening is already, right, by 1945, there's partitioning of the peninsula. Soviet forces the northern half of the peninsula and U.S. forces in the south. And then, of course, in Japan, we see a period of Allied occupation. And Koreans who remain in Japan during this time very much are acutely aware, again, of the fact that they're not, in fact, liberated at all. So, thinking about this and then thinking about, too, then how the terms themselves that are used to think through and talk about the colonial period, which is now configured, right, as the past, as past that needs to be occluded in some ways. The terms themselves are emerging, right, as contemporary terms. They're changing. Terms are changing, but that ironically precludes them from coming to terms with the terms, I say, of the past.
Yeah, the way that kind of post-war or post-liberation discourse is freighted with the terminology and the linguistic legacies, really, of that earlier period. You bring that out very powerfully. Also, in this first chapter of the second half, or the chapter four, you introduced us to Kim Tal-soo, who you describe as the sort of father of Zainichi literature, the literature of those Koreans based in Japan. Could you say something a bit more about him and what light his work sheds on this period?
Kim Tal-soo, yes, is really held up as major kind of the starting point in some ways, or the father of Zainichi Korean literature, in part because he had a huge hand in conceptualizing and in promoting right, Zainichi Korean literature as a visible category within Japan. So he's somebody who he was born and raised in colonial Korea, grew up speaking, again, Korean in the household, but was educated under the Japanese colonial educational system. He moves to mainland Japan when he's 10, actually, so when he's quite young, and thereafter he remains in Japan with his family. He is very leftist during this time, and he's an important example, I think, of a Korean writer who became heavily involved in both politics and literary culture in Japan, which, especially during this period, were considered one and the same. So, for example, he was a member of various Zainichi political organizations, but also a member of the Japan Communist Party and this leftist literary organization called Shinhyun Bungakkai, or Organization for New Japanese Literature. So it's just a reminder that, Koreans were very actively kind of engaging conversations with their Japanese peers, but vice versa, too. So a lot of these Japanese organizations are actively recruiting Koreans during this time, in part because the inclusion of former colonial subjects could serve as proof, they thought, that they were providing a united front against fascism, against imperialism, against feudalism, and so on.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah. And you kind of explore this further, the sort of Zainichi embeddedness in broader Japanese trends in this immediate post-war period, the occupation period when of course, the United States forces are still in Japan immediately after the war. So could you say something about the literary trends, if you like, that kind of evolved in Japan in the aftermath of the war and how Korean writers sought to express their identities through this?
Mm-hmm. So Kim Il-sung is, again, is a good example, I think, of thinking through what's happening in immediate post-war Japan, which sees the resurgence of Marxism. Right? Marxism enjoyed a considerable amount of prestige in Japan and elsewhere in Asia, in part because of what was seen as its ability to resist imperialism and militarism. A lot of Marxist intellectuals and activists during the 1930s and 1940s had been thrown into jail right by the Japanese state for their anti-imperial and anti-war writings and speeches. And it's precisely because of that, when they're reemerging in this post-war climate, that they can say, we never participated in the war. We were the ones from the very beginning saying that this was bad. So they're able to gain a certain kind of legitimacy. And people like Kim Il-sung and other Zainichi Koreans during this time are joining these movements in part because they too agreed with the general tenets that were laid out. With that said, there was always tensions within organizations like the Japan Communist Party, which very much prioritized, once again, national interests over international ones, and often did not actually think about what it might mean, that Koreans in Japan are still very much disenfranchised and right after 1952 are stateless and so on. These are not issues that these organizations are really addressing. And so Kim Il-sung, he forms his own organizations and he's trying to create journals and other kinds of outlets through which to explore, I think, and to center Zainichi Korean subjectivity. But again, this task is complicated by the fact that he and other Koreans who remain in Japan during this time, they have to do so in Japanese, which was itself the embodiment of colonialism writ large. So in Chapter 5, I tried to uncover the ways that language ideology intersects with Cold War politics during this time to create the conditions in which Zainichi Korean literature as a seemingly self-evident category emerges. From the very beginning, it's defined as literature written in Japanese, but not considered to be Japanese literature.
Right. And it does seem extraordinary, really, the persistence, even right up to the present, of unawareness that you mentioned in the case there of the Japanese communists, but also Japanese society at large of Korean experience in Japan and what it means that they've been stateless for long periods up to the present the way that you suggest the writers were trying to express this and trying to deal with their positionality, their subjectivity within post-imperial Japan, I think you bring all of that out extremely well. In terms of the actual, the kind of more thorny or even more thorny issues of the colonial legacy and of the past, you discuss in Chapter 6 questions around collaboration, responsibility, and how Korean and Japanese people really negotiated their way around who was involved in the imperial project, who was responsible. So how did that sort of work itself out in the in literary works as distinct Korean and Japanese nation states and their associated national literatures and languages were forged in the 50s and beyond?
Mm-hmm. In both post-war Japan and post-liberation Korean, again, I'm using these terms kind of with air quotes, yes. the question of collaboration and war responsibility becomes an extremely urgent one, related again to this issue of making sense of, but then also potentially correcting the evils of the past, as it was said. But the very fact that there emerges, once again, these two different terms, so war responsibility versus colonial collaboration, shows how narratives of the past were bifurcated along national lines after 1945, which then, right, plays a huge role in redefining literary boundaries as well. So, when referring to the Japanese involvement to the Japanese state, Japanese individuals who were involved in promoting war rhetoric or colonial agendas, the term that was overwhelmingly used after 1945 was Sensō Sekinisha. So, literally, someone who is responsible for the war. And so just in this invocation of the word war, one can tell that the context here is the 15-year war and the military aggression that was waged against China and the Allied powers. But in newly liberated Korea, in contrast, the word that was used to describe collaboration often was Chinrapa, or Shimichiha in Japanese, pro-Japanese, someone who is close to the Japanese. So in other words, it was the Japanese colonization of Korea that became the base context for definition, and ethnic Koreans who were the target of this term. And I go on and talk about how, I mean, the fact that it was not imperialism, but war culpability that became the dominant discourse in Japan had much to do with U.S. occupation policy. Also kind of has to do, too, with historically the ways in which during the colonial period, the borders of Japan, Nihon, were historically overdetermined, as you mentioned actually earlier in our conversation. So this word could stand in simultaneously for empire and nation. And so the post-war imagining of Japan as a nation state consisting primarily of the islands of Honshu, Hokkaido, Kyushu, and Shikoku was not a radical redefinition so much as the ascendancy of a discourse that had already existed in some form, which then explains too just how easily how seamlessly it almost seems as if, right, the memory of a time in which Koreans had theoretically been included in the category of Japanese literature could easily be banished or erased.
Yeah, and the story that you tell here is one that is as much of memory as it is of forgetting, really, the selectiveness of how things are memorized or memorialized and recalled, and how that is rooted in senses of where national territory is and what the boundaries of historical projects like empire, what kind of boundaries they fell within. All of that is so important, as you so clearly lay out. You end with an epilogue, which I think kind of captures so much of what we've discussed so far today. You mention a writer who you actually refer to way back at the beginning there, the first Ainichi writer to win the Akutagawa Prize, Ri Kaisei, who was born in Karafuto in southern Sakhalin, another Japanese colony of the period. Could you say something about what his story and his experience in Japan in the years after he returned have kind of how that's encapsulated lots of what we've discussed?
Mm-hmm. Ri Kaisei is so interesting, so fascinating, in part again because I mean thinking about maybe a buzzword, but say a border crossings, his entire life is just a series of border crossings, and then also being constrained by different borders at various times. So he's born, as you say, in Karafuto, which was a colony of Japan at the time, to Korean parents. So his parents had moved there from colonial Korea. And in terms of issues of just sheer census and so forth, he would have been counted technically as Japanese. Grows up, his first language is Japanese again because he's being educated under Japanese colonial educational system. After 1945, he and his family are repatriated to mainland Japan. And they're actually able to do so. They're included in a boat for Japanese repatriates because the father had a Japanese passport. He had managed to get his hands on a Japanese passport. And so they're moved to Hokkaido, in fact. And then from there, they move their way to the mainland. But again, after 1945, the political status of Koreans is extremely unstable, and the family decides to stay in Japan for the time being. But of course, that then leads to almost an involuntary immobility after 1952 when they're rendered stateless. And De Keyse, throughout his writings, and I talk a little bit about one particular one called Shōnin no Inai Kōke, so a landscape in which there are no witnesses, or a scene in which there are no witnesses, about how even as borders are shifting around him, he himself cannot help but remember, cannot help but talk about different types of borders that constituted him as a subject and that continue to constitute him. So really interesting issues related to, kind of different protagonists in his stories struggling to even articulate, to know how to articulate who they are, how they figure into the landscape they find themselves, precisely because the terms themselves are shifting underneath them. And throughout this, the Japanese language remains the primary mechanism and the fulcrum through which colonization, colonialism is not only thought about, but in which it is operated, through which it operates.
I mean, so, I just reflecting on the book as a whole, it's such a difficult thing to write about, given that this sort of floating, this indeterminacy is so much a part of the entire picture that you're painting here. So I think you've done a terrific job of bringing it all together. So maybe just a quick last question, since this is something you reflect on a bit towards the end of the book too. What of the fate or the concept of a wider Japanophone or Japanese language literature, what prospects are there for kind of seeing this in a broader frame? How is Japanese literature seen in Japan today, and where do Zainichi writers now fit into the picture?
Thank you for the question. I have been thinking about it actually a lot recently because I was asked just this past year to contribute a chapter on this upcoming MLA Options for Teaching volume on teaching postwar Japanese literature in a North American context. And this is that is the question that I think about in the essay. I guess I would say the past few decades has really seen an exciting and rich boom in scholarship on issues related to Japanese empire, diaspora, postcolonialism, and I very much have benefited from this scholarship. I think many people have benefited from this scholarship. And yet, this myth of Japan as a homogeneous nation, I think, persists, at least among my students, among the general public. And so trying to think about why that might be, even as issues involving Asian American multiculturalism, for example, are something that students readily acknowledge and are engaging with. Why is it that they can do that, but then when it comes to thinking about Japanese literature, suddenly, those distinctions fall apart? And I don't think it's that they don't understand the question of diversity in East Asian contexts. Rather, I think maybe that diversity itself needs to be historicized and conceptualized for them. So while my research is primarily concerned with exploring issues of canonization in modern Japan and Korea, very broadly defined, through the lens of the Japanese language, I hope that it helps highlight how the formation of distinct literary canons is a mutually constitutive and global process, and one that is still very much ongoing to this day.
Well, that's a fantastic kind of inviting way to end. I think it encourages us to think about these issues carefully and not to make any presumptions about where the boundaries of literary canons and indeed where the legacies of empire end. So thank you very much, Christina. It's been fantastic talking to you, and thank you very much for appearing. Before I let you go, perhaps I could just ask you a final question, which is what is it that you're currently working on? What projects do you have on the go?
My current project is, I think, like many people, in some ways an extension, or it comes out of this book, and I'm really interested actually in the discursive formation of what is now called Hikiage Bungaku, so repatriation literature, and this question of repatriation comes into play. And I'm very much interested in the movements, right, of, for example, former Japanese colonizers coming back or being forced to come back to mainland Japan after 1945. And what's striking is that many people end up producing memoirs about their experiences. And a lot of Japanese women, women in particular, are able to become quite successful, actually, in publishing these memoirs. So I'm interested in not only how and why this comes to be, but then also the form of the memoir itself, form as producing a certain type of narrative, and that narrative, of course, then being a certain type of remembering about the past. So, and as you mentioned, this question of kind of remembering versus forgetting is such a crucial one in post-1945 Japan. And a lot of people talk about the amnesia of empire, but what's so striking in looking at these different works that are produced about repatriation is that in some ways that memory of empire never goes away. In fact, it's constantly talked about. It's constantly being brought up time and time again, not only by, for example, kind of right-wing nationalists, but then also by leftist intellectuals like Tsumi Shinsuke and so on. But then I guess the larger question is then, what do we mean when we say remembering versus forgetting? And what does the form itself do to produce certain types of narratives versus others? So that's what I'm currently working on.
Well, that's brilliant. I think from Hokkaido, I fully agree that certainly where Japan is concerned, the feeling of empire doesn't dissipate particularly quickly. But that sounds like it'll be a wonderful complement to your foregoing work. So can't wait to see what comes out of it. But Christina, thank you very much again for appearing on the show. It was really
great to talk to you.
Listeners, thank you as ever for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast on the New Books Network, as you well know, and we will speak to you very soon. Goodbye.